Questions? So, most problems can't be solved exactly. So we've been looking at approximation methods. Perturbation theory, check. Great method. Variational method, check. It's a pretty simple method. It doesn't give us real general results, but for the ground state or the first excited state, pick your favorite function, plug it in here, and you're guaranteed that the answer is greater than or equal to the ground state energy. Under ideal circumstances, usually put some adjustable parameters in your trial wave function and adjust those constant to give the lowest possible upper bound. But that's not what we did last time. Last time we investigated what I hope is kind of an old-fashioned technique, but it serves its purpose, the linear combination of atomic orbits. So the idea is that we have exactly solved the hydrogen atom, and I guess atoms are nice, but molecules are better. So if we want to figure out what the wave function is for an entire molecule, how are we going to go about doing that? I mean, obviously the electron is going to wander all over that molecule, and so we need a function that wanders all over that molecule. And a simple idea is that the wave function is going to be a linear combination of the atomic wave functions. So, you know, in our simple one-dimensional picture of it, we had one atom and one atomic wave function and one atom and another wave function, and we just took either a symmetric or anti-symmetric combination of those two to make a wave function that encompassed both nuclei. And I think the reason that this is somewhat easy is that inside this Hamiltonian there are derivatives to take, and usually that's kind of a mess. But since these things solve the atomic problem, this piece of the Hamiltonian, when it operates on psi, just gives us the energy times psi. So we don't actually have to take any derivatives. We do end up with some integrals to do. And this is generic, not just for the case we covered. So we have the overlap integral, where we have atomic wave functions on different nuclei. How much do they overlap? We have the so-called direct integral, where we have the wave function for one nuclei, but we're using the potential for the other nuclei. And the so-called exchange integral, where we have one of each and one of the potentials in there. And the result of the calculation is that if we look at the electronic energy and add in the proton-proton repulsion, we get a picture kind of like this. So there's a spot where there's a minimum energy, and our guess is that that's where the system is going to sit at minimum energy. And in fact, what Born and Oppenheimer said is that we can think about the nuclei vibrating with this electronic potential energy. So there would be a vibration level, and we could have more vibration, more vibration, more vibration. If we have too much vibrational energy between the nuclei, then the system will dissociate. And all of that is seen perfectly well with, say, H2, where I think the 14th vibrational level is enough to disassociate H2. Question. So in the problem we just solved, we had two protons and one electron. You know, kind of the reverse is to have two electrons and one proton. So we're thinking about two electron atoms. There, the fly in the ointment is the electron-electron repulsion. Kind of a mess to do integral-wise because it depends on the vector difference between the location of the two electrons. And obviously, we want the wave function to care about exactly where these electrons are. I mean, if they have the same separation from the nucleus but are not in the same direction, then there's not going to be much electron-electron repulsion. So what we did for homework is we wrote down a trial wave function that actually cared about the magnitude of the vector between the two electrons. And we're able to get pretty good results on the ground state energy of the helium ion. And perhaps, at the time at least, an important fact had to do with the H- ion. So chemists are all the time talking about H+, but hydrogen can pick up an electron. And it turns out that that's an important contributor to the opacity of the sun's atmosphere. And so it was, when people were trying to calculate how the sun worked, it was critical to know where these energy levels are for H minus. So it turns out it just has one bound state, and the bound state energy is comparable to the energy in the light that's going through the sun. So an important consideration. Questions? Variational? Rayleigh-Ritz? Computationally easy, quadratically accurate, not general, that is to say, pretty much just ground state and first excited state. And I believe the most common way these days that atomic molecular calculations are actually done. But not as a linear combination, I hope, not as a linear combination of atomic orbits, with more general sort of functions, with adjustable constants. Okay, next chapter. So the plan is that variational stuff will be due Wednesday. WKB approximation stuff, the next chapter, is an approximation that at least seems to be giving us an approximation for the wave function. It's a general approximation, that is to say, it's not something that's particular to quantum mechanics. And I might say that the variational method also has lots of applications outside of quantum mechanics. So WKB approximation applies to the differential equation that. And that's almost like the, you know, most famous differential equation for a simple harmonic oscillator, except instead of omega being a constant, we have something that's variable. And we're thinking about it as a function of x, but of course the differential equation doesn't care whether you're talking about x or t. So the same thing would apply to a time equation. So here, of course, this omega was 2 pi over the period. If we're thinking about space, this k is basically 2 pi over the wavelength. And it kind of works out, I think, pretty much the way you would expect. That is to say that if k were a constant, we would expect a solution that was kind of like k times x. And if k is varying with position, about the most corresponding thing you could have to that would be the integral of k dot dx, right? Add up these little bit of wavelengths. And it turns out that the amplitude that we get depends on the value of k. Now, while the wave function result, which we'll prove in a second, is, seems to be maybe the main event, the most practical application of, I would say, the most common application of WKB has to be as a way of finding eigenenergies. And basically, all we're requiring is in a bound state, if we add up the total phase, what we have to get is an integer. So if we're starting sine at 0, when we reach the other bound state, other turning point, we're expecting also to get 0. So we're going to have an integer number of pi's as we go between point A and point B. Now, it's kind of important to see where the E is in this formula. So if we start again with Schrodinger's equation. And get it into the WKB formula. What we're going to have is minus psi double prime is equal to 2m over h bar e minus v. And so, of course, it's the square root of this. So inside this integral, there is an energy dependence. And when we do this integral, we're going to get a function of energy equals an integer number of pi's. And then we have to inverse this process, right? Because we really want a formula for energy equals some function of n, where n is kind of the quantum number. Okay. Well, let's do something else while we're at it. Kind of, what is K? So we're thinking, of course, that E minus V, that should be the kinetic energy. And the kinetic energy we think of course, as P squared over 2m. So this K is just the momentum, divided by H bar. Having written that, we want to be a little bit careful, because I hope you know that the momentum operator, right, is that. So this is a different sort of momentum. This is some sort of calculated momentum that depends on position. It's not the momentum operator per se. If we look at how this equation is going to work, I've told you lots of times that in an energy level diagram, the spacing of the levels is proportional to the classical frequency. So for example, for the hydrogen atom, large orbits are slow orbits, so the levels are close together. In the particle in a box, high energy are fast moving particles that are bouncing between fixed length walls, so the frequency is going to get higher as we go to more and more energy. And we see that in these energy levels. So I've said that. We're now in a position to prove this in the context of the WKB approximation. So what I'm going to do is take the derivative with respect to energy of both sides of this equation. And let's start by taking the derivative of the momentum with respect to energy. So that's just without the H bar. If I take the derivative of this formula with respect to energy, the first thing I'm going to do is bring down a 1/2 and get that quantity to the minus 1/2. And then when I take the derivative of the inside, I'm going to get a 2m. So what this is it's m divided by p, right? Which is, of course, 1 over the velocity. So if I take the derivative of this side with respect to energy, what I'm going to get is, well, the 1 over h bar, and then I'm going to have the integral of dx over the velocity. And I'm going to have a pi here, and then the derivative of n with respect to energy. Well, dx divided by the velocity. So for any dx, if it's moving fast, it's a small time. This is just dt. So we're adding up dt from one turning point to the other. So this thing here is going to be half the period. So if we kind of rearrange things a little bit, bring the dE, dN to this side of the equation, bring the 2 up, bring the h bar up, 2 pi over the classical period is the classical frequency, so we've got the energy spacing, dE, dN is just the classical frequency times h bar. Okay. Well, how do we prove WKB approximation? And what's involved in the approximation? That is to say, when I do the proof, we should know to what extent it's an approximation, to what extent it's an exact result, right? This is the exact differential equation. So if I'm going to have things that are oscillating, I wrote this as a sine, but you know, kind of a more generic formula for something that's oscillating is to have e to the I times something. So S is what I'm trying to figure out. So if I take psi prime, I'm going to bring down an is prime. I'm going to have left over e to the is, which is just psi. If I take psi double prime, I can do this all again. But I could also take the derivative of this. So minus psi double prime, that's equal to s prime squared minus I s double prime times psi. That wants to equal k squared times psi. Okay, well, so the approximation I'm going to make is that this term is small. And of course, what small has to be made in comparison to something. So I'm going to say it's small in comparison to the other term, the s prime squared. And if this term is small, then we have that s prime is equal to k. And if s prime is equal to k, then s is equal to the integral of k of x dx. Okay, so first of all, let's take a look at this statement about where the approximation is valid. So what we have is that s double prime, which is k prime, is supposed to be a lot less than s prime squared, which is just k squared. And I don't know, k's to me are a little bit harder to understand than wavelengths, so let's try and write this same thing in terms of wavelengths, remembering that k is 2 pi over the wavelength and not caring a whole lot about the 2 pi. So k prime then is going to be 1 over lambda squared lambda prime, the change in wavelength with distance, and k squared is going to be 1 over lambda squared. So what we're really saying then is that the change in wavelength per length is small. I know, to me, even that is a little bit hard to understand. It's certainly unitless, which is good because only unitless things could be said to be less than one. So I at least like to multiply and divide this by lambda. So if I take lambda prime times lambda and think about that as a Taylor series expansion, what that is, that would be the change in wavelength in one wavelength. So what we're saying then is the fractional change in a wavelength is small. To me, that makes more sense. I don't know if it helps you. And basically, this is saying whether the wavelength is well defined or not. Right? If I go through one wavelength and things have changed radically, then I'm not going to see something that even looks like a wavelength. But if the fractional change in the wavelength in a wavelength is small, then you have something like a well-defined wavelength. I don't know. So if you don't like that, that's certainly a perfectly good mathematical statement. And what is true is this is for sure going to be violated if k squared goes to zero, right? Then for sure k prime is going to be big compared to k squared. Where is k squared going to be equal to zero? Well, it's equal to zero when the energy is equal to the potential energy. That is to say, at the turning points, right? So if we have a potential, say, that looks like that, and an energy that looks like that, this is the inner turning point, this is the outer turning point, and for sure, our WKB approximation isn't going to be good right there. Right? Presumably, it's going to be good if we're in the middle. Okay, well, we can do a little bit better for a WKB approximation than we've done so far by iterating it. So we have said that S can be approximated as the integral of k dx. It's not going to be perfect, so let's add in some small quantity epsilon and see if we can figure out what epsilon is. See if we can improve our estimate. So now, if I do this process, yeah, so when I take the derivative, I get S prime, and S prime is all of that. Actually, let's write it out that way. So I'm going to bring down a k plus epsilon prime times psi. And now I'm going to do that twice. So I'm going to get minus k plus epsilon squared. And I've got S double prime. And I could write that out, but I'm going to write that as k prime at least currently. Okay, so minus psi prime is equal to, so this is going to be k squared plus 2k epsilon plus epsilon squared, but I'm going to neglect the epsilon squared because epsilon is going to be small. And here I have a minus I k prime. All of this times psi wants to equal k squared times psi. Okay, so we have this big cancellation, which means that this stuff here better be zero. So it better be the case that 2k epsilon prime, this was primed, right, is equal to I k prime. And this is a reasonably nice differential equation. So I have epsilon prime is I 1 half k prime over k. K prime over k we can recognize as being the derivative of the logarithm. And if we put the 1 half in there, this is I times the logarithm of the square root of k prime. So epsilon has to be equal to I natural logarithm of the square root of k plus some constant. And of course, if I add a constant to S, all it does is be a phase factor, and that's of no great significance. If I have this additional term though, what I'm going to have then is e to the minus logarithm of the square root of k. And that's equal to 1 over the square root of k. So that's our advertised approximation method. And we could do, if we wanted to, we could now add higher order terms, etc. But this is kind of where people get tired of doing it. The formula we've got, so let me write it again. Not in terms of sine, but in terms of exponentials. So what we have is psi is about equal e to the I integral of kx dx, 1 over the square root of k. So, I don't know, just kind of testing out whether this is a nice kind of looking approximation. You remember the current, which was something that was supposed to be a constant, and it was proportional to psi star derivative going this way and that times psi. And if I take the derivative, I'm going to bring down a k. I'm going to have two k's here, so in fact, this is going to be about constant. So that's good, right? Because J, the current density, was supposed to be a constant, and it's at least it's approximately a constant for our WKB approximation. So what does this say about kind of the nature of the wave function here? So where we have a lot of kinetic energy, that's where we have a lot of momentum. And if we have a lot of momentum, then we're going to have a short wavelength. And remember that that's just basically de Broglie, right? De Broglie said that the wavelength was h over p. So if I have a lot of P, I'm going to have a small wavelength. So here I'm going to have a very short wavelength. And because K is in the denominator, I'm going to have a small amplitude. As I move to a region where K is getting smaller, the kinetic energy is getting smaller, then I'm going to have a bigger amplitude and a longer wavelength. But I really kind of shouldn't believe the WKB approximation as I approach that turning point, right? Because that's exactly where this circled equation is going to be violated. So what do we do there? Well, if we have what's called a linear turning point, that is to say that we can approximate the potential as a line, it turns out that that's a solvable problem. So a linear potential is the same thing as a constant force, so we're actually back to 191. And it turns out that while the problem is solvable, it's not solvable with functions that are on your calculator. The answer is in terms of area integrals. Area is a person. But it's solvable. And what we find is that the solution looks kind of like this. And what's important about this is that the phase of the wave function when it goes through the turning points is at 45 degrees. So here we said that if we wanted to have a node, we wanted to have that be at pi, but we're not going to actually have a node. We're going to be 45 degrees before a node. So instead of having n, we're going to have a quarter of 180 degrees, which is to say we're going to have a pi over 4 difference there. If we have a linear turning point at both ends, then we're going to do this twice. And we're going to get an n minus a half. If we have a particle in a box where we go to infinity, then we are actually going to have nodes at the end, and we're not going to want to do that subtraction. Okay, so the upshot of all of this is we have n in the WKB approximation only if we have infinite go to zero sort of boundary conditions. If we have linear turning points, then we're going to want to subtract a quarter for each one of them. So for example, a problem like this, we're going to have an actual node here, and we're going to end up here with having n minus a quarter for our turning points. Is that okay? Maybe. So something like this, we're actually going to have nodes at the end. We're going to use n. For something like this, we're going to have n minus a half. Kind of all the cases, so I guess enumerating them isn't so bad. So this is how Griffiths does it, and I think this is how I like doing it. But pretty commonly in books, instead of this being n minus a half, you'll see it as being n plus a half. And it isn't any different, right? So if we have n plus a half, then we have n starting at 0. So we get 1 half, 3 halves, etc. If we have the n minus a half, we have n starting at 1, and we get exactly the same set. So don't be confused about that difference. But I think I applaud Griffiths for using his n minus a half. In part because if we have this sort of circumstance, it makes more sense than to say n plus 3 quarters. But there are, the reason people choose the n plus a half is if you want to get like the simple harmonic oscillator answer, you know that's n plus a half and n starts at zero. So often in order to reproduce the famous formula, you want to use the n plus a half as opposed to the n minus a half. And we'll see that in an example maybe. Now proving this, the Airy function, the 45 degree phase, it's kind of a mess and I'm not gonna do it. It's in the book. And it's not fundamentally useful. Once you know that the answer is simple, you just subtract a quarter of, just subtract 45 degrees for every linear turning point. Okay. The other thing that is kind of hidden in this answer that is worth stressing is there's no reflection. So when we solve the problem of a wave function that was incident on some sort of square wave, we not only had to e to the I kx, we also had to have e to the minus I kx. And according to this, we don't need the minus piece of it. We just need the positive piece of it. So that's a true result. There is no or small reflection if the change in wavelength and a wavelength is small. Here, there's a huge change in the wavelength at a spot, and that's the source of the reflection. If we smooth out this square well and make it rounded, then there's going to be considerably less approaching zero reflection. We could incidentally do exactly the same stuff for the case of no sign difference. And all that does is make K imaginary. And it means that we're going to have solutions like that that are the exponentially rising and falling solutions that we've run into before. And I think we'll make use of that next time. But it's kind of no big deal. Oh, I guess the other thing, kind of miscellaneous factoid that I want to tell you, not of any particular relevance. So we have this integral of k or p dx. These things are called action integrals. And they play a big role in advanced classical mechanics. And they played a big role in Bohr's theory, where Bohr's, the so-called old quantum mechanics, would set this equal to h bar times n, or sometimes in order to make things work, it had to be n plus a half. And of course, to Bohr, it was all kind of puzzling, but we now see when we want to use n and when we want to use n plus a half. Depends on the nature of the turning points. So Bohr's theory is basically WKB approximation without the waves, right? So he kind of just spontaneously said, let's quantize the action integrals. That's actually not what he said, but that's what his words came to mean in old quantum theory. Okay. An example. Well, I'm going to do kind of a longish, ugly, but meaningful example. And that's the H atom. So what we've got for the hydrogen atom is minus H bar over 2m psi double prime. And then we've got a potential that is minus z e squared over r psi, and that wants to equal e psi. And what we did is we said that psi wanted to be a radial part times a ylm, and then we got a somewhat simpler equation for are and I'm getting a little bit lazy, forgetting my 4 pi epsilon naughts in the potential. This doesn't cut it for us, right? Because this is not in WKB form. It's got this first derivative term. So the next thing we did is we said U was equal to R times R, and then we got it into exactly WKB form. And now we can apply a WKB approximation. So let's kind of put everything on the other side of the equation to get our k squared. So what I've got is minus u double prime is going to be equal to 2m over h bar squared times e plus z squared 4 pi epsilon naught r minus h bar squared ll plus 1 divided by 2m r squared, all of that times u. So we can read off what k is, and we should be good to go. All we have to do is do the integral. Well, there's kind of a fly in the ointment. These u wave functions, they don't go to zero at minus infinity, right? They look kind of like that. They go to zero at r equals zero. So that isn't exactly the way the linear approximation says it's got to be, so we really should adjust it. So if we make a coordinate transformation and make the point r equals 0 go to minus infinity, we can have, now let me call this new variable q. If we make that coordinate change, then we mess up the differential equation. We end up with a first order term like we had with r. And it turns out there's a well-defined method for getting rid of that linear term. And after the dust settles, all that happens is instead of having ll plus 1, what we get is l plus a half squared. So those two only differ by a quarter, but it makes a difference. I don't know if Griffiths doesn't know about this trick or was just didn't want to introduce it, but there's the facts. If you're doing something in three dimensions with WKB, you really should replace the LL plus 1 by L plus a half squared. Okay, so we have our formula for K. K is the square root of all of this stuff. Oops, L plus a half now. And what we're supposed to do is to integrate kr dr between the turning points and set this equal to pi times n minus a half. So kind of the setup, if I were to plot the effective potential for the hydrogen atom, I have the attractive electron-proton, and then I have the repulsive centrifugal barrier, and so at some energy, I've got some turning points, and I'm supposed to then integrate this between A and B and set that equal to n minus a half. So first of all, this is one of those circumstances where if I want to get the classical formula, I'm going to want to call this nr plus a half. So you remember that nr was the number of radial modes that we had, a number of radial nodes that we had for the wave function in between those two guys. So nr is the thing that went from zero on up. The other thing that's a little bit tricky about doing this integral is remembering that the energy is negative. I mean, when we see E, there's a real strong tendency to think about it as being positive. So I'm going to replace this by minus the absolute value of E, just so perfectly clear that that's a negative quantity. And I'm going to pull out that absolute value of E. So this is going to be k equals the square root of 2m over h bar squared. And then I have the absolute value of E, and I've got minus 1 plus z e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught r minus h bar squared l plus a half squared divided by 2m r squared. Oops, if I pull it out, I should pull it out, right? And I'm also going to pull out a 1 over r squared. So this is now minus r squared plus z e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught absolute value of e r minus h bar squared l plus a half squared divided by 2m absolute value of e. And we could find these turning points by just solving this quadratic equation. So this quantity, ugly as it appears, has to be minus r minus a times r minus b, where a and b are the roots of that quadratic equation. Okay, so if we expand out this quantity, we get, of course, minus r squared plus a plus b r minus a times b. And the reason I write that out is it's pretty clear that a times b has to be that, and a plus b has to be that. And it's going to turn out we don't need to know what a and b are separately. All we really need to know is what the sum and the product is. So why bother to figure out what the quadratic equation is? It looks like a mess. When in the end, all we're going to need to know is the sum and the product. And the reason we only need to know the sum and the product is because that's all that's in the answer to the integral. So if you look up in an integral table, the integral from a to b of 1 over x, the square root of minus x minus a times x minus b, the answer is pi over 2, the square root of b minus the square root of a squared, I think. That's what I have in my notes. So, I don't know, this is kind of an interesting integral just by itself. It has an answer that's a pi, and it's not the antiderivative of anything. So you might wonder how this integral is proved, and the answer is it's proved from complex variable. This is done by a contour integral. Did you guys take complex variable or not? Okay, well, lots of interesting integrals come from contour integrals. And in particular, lots of WKB integrals. And they're always a little bit specialized since they're not antiderivatives of something. And so there's a tendency for Mathematica not to know them. So sometimes an integral table is a better shot than Mathematica for these sorts of integrals. And that's true of the homework. So I tell you that this famous integral table called Gretstein and Rizhak, which is that thick, knows things that Mathematica hasn't learned yet. Okay, so what's good for us, of course, is if I expand this out, what I get is a plus b minus 2, the square root of a times b. So what we've got then is pi times n plus a half. That's this side of the integral. We got all of this stuff that's going along for the ride. So this has got to equal the square root of 2m over h bar squared. Okay. So I lied a little bit, and this is where I pay for it. So remember that the WKB form was minus psi double prime equals k squared psi. And I did take the square root of this, but I forgot to take the square root of that. And you can see that that's what I wanted for my integral. So there's actually the square root of the absolute value of e here, not just e. And then we have for our integral pi over 2 times the sum of a plus b. And the sum of a plus b is z squared over 4 pi epsilon naught absolute value of e. And the product nicely is a square, pretty much. Okay, so what do we got going for us? Well, if I take this 2me and distribute it, notice it's going to nicely cancel that. And if I take this h bar squared, it's going to cancel that. And I've got this 1/2 here that's going to cancel that 2. So after all is said and done, from this term, I'm just going to get a minus L plus 1/2, which I'm going to bring to this side of the equation. You believe all of that?
Does the r squared, when you pulled out the 1 over r squared, are you just kind of like taking that away?
So that was inside the integral, and the integral had that 1 over, and it's not r squared anymore because I forgot to take the square root, it's just 1 over r. Okay, so if I do all of that, I get pi times L plus 1/2 plus N plus 1/2. And what I've got left over then is what? Well, square root and a full, so that's going to give us 2m over h bar squared, square root still in the denominator. And I've got a pi over 2 and z e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught. Okay. Well, I'd like to make this look as much as possible like the right answer. And the right answer is that the absolute value of e is 1/2 mc squared alpha squared divided by n squared. And the principal quantum number is equal to nr plus l plus 1. Well, check that. We've got that guy. How about alpha? So alpha is the fine structure constant that's about 137. And it was e squared over 4 pi epsilon naught h bar c. So I've got my h bar, so I just need to put in a c both places. So what I've got here then is, and let's bring this 2 inside, so I've got m 2, let me bring that c to make it c squared, absolute value of e, and I took care of the 2, the pi is still there, it's going to be canceled out eventually, and this thing here was left over as alpha. Okay, we're getting close. Cancel off the pi's. Bring this term down and bring the energy up. So we're going to get the absolute value of energy. Square this term. So we're going to get mc squared over 2. Square this term, alpha squared. This term is now in the denominator, square it. And again, the pi is canceled off at this level. So we get, for WKB approximation, we get the exact answer. And it turns out to be a very common occurrence. Most cases where you have an exact problem, WKB will also give you the exact answer. It's a surprisingly accurate method. Its worst behavior is in the ground state, because then there's only one half of an oscillation. But for excited states where you have multiple oscillations, it's typically, you know, many decimal places accurate. And of course, it's exactly for those high energy states that we have no hope with the variational method. So it can be kind of a complement to these, to the other sorts of methods.
Where did the alpha come from? I was going up or
something. So alpha is defined to be this quantity. And we had a lot of it sitting here. This h inside the radical is going to give me that. So I put a c there, and I brought a c up. And I put that c inside to give me c squared. And then this thing was sitting there as alpha. Okay, so I don't know, what's the general rule here? So the general rule is, in general, what you're going to do is you're going to look at the differential equation, find out what k is, find out what the turning points are, do this integral, and this integral is going to be some function of the energy. And we know that it's going to equal basically pi times n. And what we have to do is then invert that, right? Because we want energy as a function of n, not n as a function of the energy. And that's where all of this algebra came in, where we, in the end, were able to get E isolated on one side of the equation. Not uncommonly, you can't do that with algebra. And so you have to basically find the inverse function using Mathematica. And not in today's problem set, but in the problem set for Wednesday, I have an example like that where, as far as I know, you can't invert it, but you can use Mathematica to find the energy for any value of n. Questions? Okie doke. So I'm thinking Wednesday's work, but it could be Monday, but probably that's a mistake, right?
This Wednesday would be pretty bad.
Oh, so what's the name of it? The variational method was supposed to be due this Wednesday.
This Wednesday, okay.
It can be due.
I'm taking the GRE on tomorrow night.
Yeah.
So
you'd rather it be Friday. So you're the one who said I should be cruel to you guys, right? And
right.
Twist your arms. But I'm unfortunately not that way.
Well,
so it's due on Friday. It's fine with me.